Hello and welcome to The Lantern Bearers, preserving culture when the lights go out. I'm Walker.
And I'm Peter.
And on today's show, we are going to be discussing the top-selling books of all time, the highest-grossing films of all time, and what makes a book or film popular. And then, related to that, what makes a book or film actually a classic or a great book, and why should we care? And I have a little bit of a cold today, which is probably, like, against best practice for podcasts.
I think that is true.
Podcasts when you have a cold, but
however needs must.
Yeah, I mean, we are dedicated to bringing our dear listeners the best content every week.
If I had to pick one word to describe myself, two words, it would be dedicated podcast.
And mine would be coughing Weezer. Anyway, so, all right, so we're going to get started. So, Peter, I want you to give your honest reaction as I read off to you the list of the most sold books of all time.
Okay.
And that can be like a grunt or a groan.
It may be both.
Or
simultaneously.
A cry of joy.
And in the same respect.
So the first thing to note, the first thing I kind of found when I was doing some research on this is that it's a little hard to figure out what the top-selling book of all time is.
Okay, sure, fair.
Because, for instance, you've got, like, the Bible and the Quran.
Right.
And there's so many different versions, so many different, publishers, and oftentimes they're given away for free, so...
Okay, yes.
We just kind of have to...
Didn't really have a choice.
Yeah. We're just going to have to assume that those are somewhere at the top of the list. The consensus is that there's probably over a billion copies in existence for the Bible and the Quran. And, get this, for the quotations from Chairman Mao.
What?
Yeah, so the communist...
I suppose you don't have much of a choice there, either.
Yeah, right, exactly. So, you know, he's a communist leader responsible for the death of probably 65 million people during the Cultural Revolution in China, and he probably just handed out lots of books of his quotations or something.
Right.
So there's a lot of them in existence.
Uh-huh.
And, okay, so that part is difficult.
So
and then,
we're not really counting...
We're not counting those.
The religious, major religious texts.
Or political or...
Right.
Stuff like that.
Okay.
But even after that, it's hard to get a consensus. I looked at a lot of different lists, so this is sort of... There's not a consensus.
Okay.
But I'll give you one version that seems to have...
The version according to Walker?
Yeah, and according to this guy, James Clear.
Well, he couldn't be clearer.
Exactly.
So his name inspires
Should be
confidence.
Trustworthy. No, but these are the titles that showed up the most frequently.
Sure, just kind of an average lists. Across the lists you...
Something like that, yeah. Okay, right. So, do you want to take a whack at number one?
Is it a dictionary?
No.
Is it not a dictionary?
That would be correct.
Okay. Is it a work of fiction?
Yes. Actually, here's an interesting thing. Fiction absolutely dominates.
That doesn't surprise
the top
me, though, I suppose.
Books of all
now
time.
Now that it's not a dictionary, what else would it be? Fiction.
And maybe the dictionary falls under the category of, like, the religious texts that don't or political or whatever, that don't get counted. But
Moby Dick.
No, it's Don Quixote.
Don Quixote?
Quixote, sorry. Yes, that's what this one is putting at the top of the list.
Serious?
As probably partly because it's been around for so long.
Yeah,
considered, you know, the first novel, more
How
or
many
less.
People have you met who've read Don Quixote?
Very few.
I don't think I've ever met anyone who's read Don Quixote.
Friedrich probably has.
I gave him a copy.
Shout out to Friedrich because
he probably read it.
He probably read it, and he sort of got my wheels turning on this whole topic.
Oh.
So, credit.
Well, shout out to him.
Where credit's due.
But besides Friedrich, I don't know of anybody who's read it.
It's on my shelf. Does that count?
No. I gave Friedrich a copy when he graduated high school.
Really?
So he's probably read it.
He probably has.
So I guess
has.
You're right. He's probably the one guy I know who's read it.
But
I don't know anybody else who's read that.
I don't even
know if it has, like...
So this
a traditional plot, isn't it more a collection of kind of
it's
vignettes
episodic,
about the
I
it's
think.
Episodic, yeah.
But it doesn't show up at the top of every list.
No, but...
But I saw it on at least two different lists. It was the top one. And they put it at 500 million copies sold.
Seriously?
Yes.
500 million copies
of
Don Quixote.
That's exactly right.
That surprises me. I thought something maybe like, you know, Dickens or Melville or something like that. Even Fitzgerald or something like that.
no.
Someone you would read in a high school English class, but... I don't think most people are reading Cervantes.
No. Do you want to take a shot at number two?
I don't think I do.
Okay. So it's A Tale of Two Cities. So it is
okay,
Dickens.
So I would
number two,
I
you would have got it.
I was going to guess Tale of Two Cities.
Now, I don't know why it's that one. I mean, of all his
books. I would say that sort of makes sense.
Because why?
I'm not sure. You would have thought.
I mean, it has a political
Oliver
element.
Oliver Twist or something like that.
Yeah,
everyone
that's like
seems to have
the most
heard of that.
No, this puts it at number two, and that was common.
Huh.
Like it was often number one or number two, and 200 million copies
incredible
sold.
Book.
Yeah.
So I could see how.
I mean, you know, there is like pretty strong cultural relevance in terms of the French Revolution, I suppose.
Yeah.
But.
And just the. The themes within it, I suppose, are fairly resonant with people.
Right. So then at number three...
It's featured in... what film? In the... One of the Batman trilogy. The Nolan...
The Dark Knight Rises?
Yeah.
It is kind of
what's
in
his
there.
Face reads from it at the end.
Yeah, it's sort of
he
like...
He quotes... That's a quote from...
Sydney
Carton.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sorry, we got a lot more material
readers,
to get through.
Listeners,
dear listeners. So number three would be The Lord of the Rings.
Okay, and that...
Which they're combining as
that
one.
I knew was
it's
one
right
of the
up
most
there.
Popular...
I thought it was number one, but apparently it's number three.
I think it was one of the most popular books in the 20th century.
Probably, yeah.
In England.
20th century.
I knew it was like the most popular
book
in 20th century
England. But I think it's worldwide, too. It's number three. So
150
million copies sold. They're counting it as one volume, although it
is
of course a trilogy. Yeah.
And yeah, and I wouldn't count it any other way. I think it's fair to count it as one.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. It is really one story. So then at number four we have The Little Prince by Antoine de Saint-Exupéry.
Number four.
I
have never heard of that. I
have heard of it.
Have you heard of that?
From
The Little Prince.
Justin of all people.
Really?
Yeah.
The Little Prince.
And then there was like some random girl in one of my college classes who was...
Into The Little Prince?
Yeah. she was into it. So
she
I don't
was,
know anything about it.
The Prince Fever.
Yeah, I was
not
shocked too. I thought
Prince.
It was like a super obscure French
the
book.
The Little Prince.
Apparently it
What's
sold
it
142 million... Well, Peter, it's about a little prince.
How little
and
are we talking here?
I don't know, but it sold 142 million copies.
Good grief. I wish I sold 142 million copies of just about anything.
Out of anything, like, yeah, I mean...
My thumbprint?
Right, and who
That'd
wouldn't want to buy your thumbprint? So then, number five, of course, Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's
Stone.
Okay,
I'm actually surprised we didn't get there first.
Yeah.
Or sooner. Unfortunately, the Rowling books have sort of come to dominate everybody's notion of reading books, period. Rowling's books are certainly very captivating. I've read all of
the whole series?
The whole series.
I
think I
have not read
once.
Any of it.
And they're very captivating. I mean...
Well, evidently, 107 million people...
Agree.
Yeah.
Right.
Probably
but
a lot more than that, actually.
I don't necessarily... Well, we can talk more later about what makes a great book.
That's Yeah, that's another discussion. Okay, so number six is an Agatha Christie novel, Mystery, And Then There Were None.
And Then There Were None. I don't think I've read that one.
Yeah,
I'm surprised it's not... Doyle.
Yeah, he's not even in the top 20, I don't think.
Well, they are kind of dry.
They're kind of boring. So Agatha Christie, Mystery. I've not read this one. They clock it in at 100 million.
Oh, man. Agatha doing good for herself.
Yeah, right? Then we have, you know, this book that I'm sure is on all of our shelves, The Dream of the Red Chamber.
I dream about it every night.
So, by someone whose name I cannot even attempt to pronounce.
Let me see. Can I see the name? Point.
Alright, it's right there.
Nope.
Yeah.
Not gonna try.
I defend someone.
No, I did look this one up. Yeah, okay. Right. We would defend somebody.
It's a...
And it's basically considered the greatest piece of Chinese literature.
Okay.
It was written in the mid-18th century, kind of chronicles the rise and fall of a Chinese family.
Okay. Given the total percentage of the world population that is Chinese...
Right.
It makes sense that...
Mm-hmm.
A Chinese book would make its way
would be on the top 10. Yeah, that's number 7.
Right.
At 100 million copies. And then we have another Tolkien work, The Hobbit.
Oh.
Comes in at number 8 with 100 million copies sold. So yeah, he got two entries.
In the top 10.
Or 4 if you consider the trilogy separately.
Wow.
So,
impressive.
That's pretty cool. And I think this would be the only... Oh no, I take that back. One of 2 children's books in the top 10 here.
What's the next one?
We're getting there. So number 9 is She, A History of Adventure.
Sorry?
It's called She, A History of Adventure.
S-H-E?
Correct. By,
She.
You know, by H. Rider Haggard.
They're all Haggard.
The household name.
Right, it's on every family shelf.
Yeah.
What is it about?
I have whole rooms dedicated to H. Rider Haggard. and 100 million copies.
Serious? What's it about?
This one, I looked this up too. It's sort of a, along the lines of The Lost World kind of thing, like these explorers going into the interior of Africa, and they find a society that's ruled by a matriarch, and apparently people were really into that.
People wouldn't be able to put that down.
Right.
I love a good matriarchal thriller myself.
Exactly. So then, number 10 then is the other children's book, The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe by C.S. Lewis.
That doesn't surprise me.
Which I think deserves the spot
at
85 million copies.
I'll never think about Turkish Delight the same way.
Right. You and 85 million other people.
That's true. I always feel guilty when I eat it.
Not counting those who checked it out from the library. Okay. So that rounds out.
Why aren't we counting them out?
Well, because then... We can't count library goers. No, because that wouldn't be separate. Those wouldn't be separate copies sold.
Oh,
because they're all reading the same copy.
Well, those dang library goers.
Yeah, I know. They messed up. They messed up the whole list. So anyway, those are the top 10 most sold books.
Interesting. I am surprised. I wasn't expecting some of those.
Yeah, I was.
When we don't
I was surprised
count
about
the religious
too.
Text. That's the top
10. Yeah, the. Those are probably in the billions, but or at least over a billion.
Right. But then sometimes you go to a hotel and Gideon's forcing a Bible on you, whether you
want
it or not.
Right. So I've got 25. We'll keep it at 10 for the sake of time, but there's just for the record, there's like
a bunch more
Harry
Potter.
There
more Harry Potter?
There's
anything
a bunch
else
more
you
Harry
want to
Potter.
Pull out of there just because it's funny? Entertaining.
Anne of Green Gables is in there.
Okay.
Charlotte's Web.
Sure, whatever.
Sure, whatever.
About a spider and a pig.
There's only one nonfiction work in the top 25.
What is it?
Think and Grow Rich.
By?
Napoleon Hill.
Of course.
Yeah.
I don't know anything about that.
So, okay. Now we're going to do a similar thing, but with movies.
Okay.
Before we move on to,
I'll probably be even less good at this.
Yeah, you probably will. Before we move on to kind of, I found some interesting material about like what makes these works popular. We'll get into that in a minute. So first, you want to take a guess at the top grossing film of all time? This
probably
is
something random.
This is according to BoxOfficeMojo.com, but actually all the lists were
probably
a little more.
Measure with
yeah,
film.
They were a bit more consistent. So.
Yeah. Is it Titanic?
No, but that one's up right up there.
I would think.
What
is it?
Avatar.
Oh, jeez.
Does anybody... I've never even heard anybody talk
Good
about
grief.
Avatar.
Grief. I mean, when it came out, it was a big thing, but it's basically
because, like,
just Pocahontas with blue people.
Yeah, right. Pretty much. Park hours with blue people. And I don't even know.
Did you know?
Why was it a big thing?
Did you know that industrial greed is bad?
Is that the point of the movie?
That's the whole point. It's just like.
Yeah.
That imperialistic. Also,
here's a weird thing.
Western guys are gonna steal the lifestyle of some blue natives.
Yeah, those darn imperialists. I mean,
yeah.
It's like one of the only modern films I've ever heard of that was, I believe it was banned by the Vatican.
Avatar.
Yeah.
Banned by the Vatican.
Yeah.
On what grounds?
Because it was, because it was like too environmental. I don't even know. It was Benedict the 16th, I think.
Weird. Who blacklisted it? Current.
Yeah, I don't.
The current Vatican banning something for being too environmental.
Right, right. So then, if we go to number two is Titanic.
Okay.
So you were pretty close. You were pretty close. Oh, I should be giving the numbers here. So worldwide. Hey, buddy.
That was me.
That was not you.
Glad you checked in.
This must be in the billions. 2,780. No, what the heck am I even looking at? Can you interpret?
I think that's 2,187,000,000. Wouldn't you say?
Yeah, that must be right.
Yeah, because the domestic sales would be like what 659 million.
Million, yeah, yeah.
And another.
There's a reason that I'm not a math major.
Yeah.
I wasn't a math major. Okay, so that's so with Avatar it's 2,788,000,000. Titanic is 2,187,500,000. And then number three, this is just kinda sad. Star Wars The Force Awakens.
The Force Awakens.
Which is like one of the lesser Star Wars movies.
I've never seen that.
Really? Oh
no.
It's kinda forgettable. I'm probably gonna offend a lot of people, but
yeah. I won't say anymore.
Yeah, we'll just leave it at that. So that's number three. 2,068,000,000.
Okay.
And then we have at number four, a movie from this year, right?
Really?
Avengers Infinity War.
Serious? I didn't know.
That was this year, right?
Sure. I don't care.
Pretty sure it was this year. And 2,047,000,000.
Serious?
Mm-hmm.
Avengers. I think that's dumb.
Well, you know what? You know why it is? Is because they built up to this for so long.
Right,
there's so many different characters.
You just have to buy the.
So they got every fan of every Marvel hero to go to this movie because they were all in the same movie.
Shmarga's board of spandex.
Right. Oh, this is even more disappointing. Number five is Jurassic World.
Which is the original.
Not even the original. I don't know how that happened. I saw it.
Jurassic World
wasn't that amazing.
Wow, that's
incredible. And honestly, the CGI was like worse in that one than in the original.
Have you seen the original?
Yeah.
You've seen the original Jurassic Park.
You haven't?
No. I saw it, actually, I saw some of it last week, because it was at this bar.
Why are you circling the table?
I'm going to go turn off the light.
Okay.
And we were playing Jurassic Park, and it was just so stupid.
That's not going to, if you talk from over there, it's not going to pick up.
Well, Jurassic Park is stupid, listeners.
Okay. But probably, honestly, probably better than Jurassic World. Like, Jurassic World was just a sad ripoff. Anyway, 1,671,000,007.
What was?
Jurassic World. And then, number six, we have another, we'll just go to 10, but number six, we have another Marvel movie, Marvel's The Avengers.
Why is so much Avengers? I don't like those.
Well, nobody consulted you when they decided what movie they
well, it's
to go
just,
watch.
I don't like the ones where there's like 10 superheroes in the same film.
And the original Avengers is like low-key by those standards compared with Infinity War.
Low-key.
Because, oh gosh.
Pun intended.
Mm-hmm.
Sure.
Because there's only
there's like
40
in the
Infinity War. In the Infinity Wars, there's like, it just goes on and on.
I think I said Affinity War.
Well, there's like an affinity of warriors in it, so.
They do have an affinity for spandex.
That too. Number seven, Furious 7. Which is
like of the Fast and Furious trilogy?
Correct.
Or series or whatever those are?
Oh, it's more than a trilogy, dude. There's seven of them.
At least.
Yeah.
Oh, good grief.
Yeah, but there's probably more now. Yeah, there is more
now. I'm sad for cinema right now.
None of these, I mean,
have you?
I like some of them okay, but they're not like...
None of them should be like...
The top ten of all time, yeah. At least...
I'm a little worried about
in my humble opinion, but... Yeah, that one's over. That's $1.5 billion
for
sales. Seven. Yeah. And then,
another. Like sweaty guys driving cars into stuff.
I don't know. I'm not seeing
anything. Probably offended a bunch of people.
Yeah.
Sorry, seven people.
I think we've done a fair amount of that already.
At least with the film.
This episode.
The film seemed to excite more
derision,
indignation between the two of us.
Yeah. So number 8 is another Avengers movie, Age of Ultron.
Oh my gosh.
At almost a billion.
Is that all the Avengers movie or in the top 10? All the ones with all the Avengers in them?
Yeah, right? Yeah, because there's,
I don't know how many are.
Because there's three so far. Oh, mm-hmm. There's a fourth one coming.
I wonder if you're making it in the top 10.
Number 9 is another Marvel movie, Black Panther.
Seriously?
At $1,346,000,000.
Wow.
And that's just... In my opinion, that's not even close to the best Marvel movie, so whatever. Number 10, Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows Part 2.
Part 2?
Part 2.
Serious?
Correct.
I remember
$1,341,000,000.
You know, this has changed a lot recently, this top 10 list. I remember when, I think like 5-10 years ago, the top film was Titanic. And then it was like, the Return of the King was in there.
The Return of the King was number 2. Yeah. Now it's number 21.
Serious?
Yeah.
Films have, I think, just started grossing so much more.
Yeah, well, when you get these, you'll notice a lot of these are like parts of massive franchises.
Massive franchises that are...
Like series with, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8 installments. And, and those are what really...
And they're building up to this...
Raking the cash, yeah. I guess that's what's impressive about, in some ways, about, well, not impressive, but interesting about Avatar and Titanic is that they're standalone, the number 1 and 2. Almost all the other... Wait. All the other top 10 are parts of huge...
Part of the franchise.
Franchises, yeah.
Interesting.
So that's the top 10...
chops to Titanic,
for the movies. Not that we recommend that movie, but... And then I'm stuck on numbers. The next thing that I wanted to talk about was what makes a movie popular. And so, in my opinion, this kind of just scratches the surface, but it was some interesting material. There was a study published in the Journal of the Academy of Marketing Science, as reported on fizz.org. Which kind of looked into this, like to see what kinds of movies were most successful. And so, the biggest thing they found, or the biggest correlation they found, was if it's a really, really popular actor, that seems to really draw a lot of people to the movie. Mm-hmm. So star power is still a pretty substantial predictor of a film's success.
Which, I'm trying to think in the top 10 you read.
Yeah. Well,
I mean, Robert, there's a lot of stars in like the Avengers series.
Yeah, like Robert Downey Jr., I believe, is the highest paid actor ever.
Seriously? Yeah. Robert Downey Jr.?
Yeah. Pretty sure. I'd have to double check that.
Interesting.
But Google it.
I mean, like, Leo is in Titanic. Mm-hmm. Kate, what's her face?
You refer to him as Leo.
Everyone refers to him as Leo, man.
I don't.
With the times. Yeah. But, like, can you think of a single actor in Avatar other than, like, blue face paint?
Blue face paint was kind of the star.
I would like to thank blue face paint for making this possible.
Yeah, no, I don't know.
Interesting. But I can see that for most of those. I mean, like,
for a lot of them, it's big. It's big.
Robert Downey Jr.
But I think
Leonardo did something or other. What's his face?
DiCaprio?
That's the man.
Wow.
The kid in Harry Potter.
Yeah, right. But I think, you know, like we just mentioned, a big factor too is that these are parts of series that,
sure,
as they progress, they gather more and more fans.
Is
but
that something that...
That's not something that showed up in this study, oddly enough. They said, yeah, so star power is big, but over time, the influence of the star wanes.
Okay.
Whereas the influence...
People don't know about it.
Yeah, that's probably part of it. But I think they even mean like with an individual film, maybe. I'm not sure. Or maybe just over decades. But whereas the influence of an actor who has been like officially recognized as a good actor, like probably an Oscar or something, sure, remains more steady. So if you've got an Oscar winner in your movie, that's going to give more long-term, over the course of probably many years, that's going to be a better predictor than just someone who's, like, super popular with the fans, you know. And sometimes those are the same. But yeah, in fact, a movie with an actor who has won awards is the best predictor of the success of that film, financially.
Really?
Mm-hmm. According to this study.
Well, I suppose that's why Robert Downey Jr. makes so much money. Yeah. Although I don't know that he's particularly awarded.
Has I don't even know. Oscar? I don't even know. I don't think he has. I mean, he's won awards, but I don't think he's won an Oscar. Someone probably knows that.
Someone does.
Someone knows that. Someone listening to this.
Someone's probably Googling it right now.
Yeah, and someone else is like, how can they not know who's that Robert Downey Jr. won an Oscar? Whatever.
Well, how many people know that?
I don't know. Well, he is, like, one of the most popular actors of the day.
Okay.
But the other thing the study kind of commented on was that the waning impact of stars is partly the result of those stars acting in more mediocre movies. Like the directors have figured out, gosh, if I have a star in my movie, it's going to really make it better. And so they just get him into a stupid script, and the, you know... So people realize that, and that makes it less of a draw, maybe, than it used to be, I guess.
Right.
And then the next big factor is just how many positive reviews has the movie received from critics,
not primarily. Audience members.
I mean, I think that plays into it, too, but critics still play a pretty big role in that. So that drives people to see the movie. Now, you know, so in my opinion, that tells us a certain amount of what makes a movie popular, but like it doesn't tell us what makes a critic give a positive review. That they didn't really touch on, and that's probably harder to answer. But at any rate, that a positive review from a lot of critics will make more people go to it. So
interesting.
That and then kind of the actors, it sounds like, even more so apparently than directors.
What about books?
Yeah, so if we look at books, what makes a book popular? I found, you know, multiple different studies on this, and again, there's only so much that, like, a scientific study can tell us about this, because it's mathematically driven, and we're talking about literature, but, so you have to take this with a grain of salt, but according to The Telegraph, a group of computer scientists from Stony Brook University in New York had developed an algorithm which can analyze and predict a book's success commercially with an 84% accuracy.
Wow.
Yeah. So here's what they did. They use my favorite technique, statistical stilometry.
Oh yes.
Which, you know, I engage in on a daily basis.
Of course you do.
Anyway, it basically examines the use of words and grammar in the book. And so they downloaded a bunch of classic books from Project Gutenberg and had the computer scan them and identify patterns, right, in the use of the language and such. And then they compared the computer's predictions as to the success of these books with the historical data of how the book actually did. And so that's where they get the 84% accuracy.
Interesting.
Number. Some of the factors that they said played into this were interestingness. You know, whatever that means.
Sure.
The interestingness of a book, how engaging the storyline was, or an engaging storyline, novelty, style of writing, and also a certain amount of luck. But then if we look at it a little more closely, one trend that they found was that successful books use a lot of conjunctions, such as and but.
Sure.
And a lot of nouns and adjectives.
Interesting.
Whereas on the other hand, less successful works tended to include more verbs and adverbs and words that explicitly describe actions and emotions. So for example, you know, he wanted to die. Or he You know, he wanted this, or he obvious, he was sad, you know.
Sure.
Something that was more...
This man was very sad.
Direct, yeah. Whereas the successful works used verbs that described thought processes, such as recognized or remembered.
Interesting.
So maybe, I don't know if that indicates like they were more subtle about communicating how the person, the character feels, or...
That kind like, of makes
just
sense.
Like, he's sad. It's like, he remembered... Sad. When his dog died, and then, right. you know, and the implication is that he was sad, but
right.
The samples for the bad books, like the less successful works, were drawn from low ranking books on Amazon. So you know, like my book probably,
right. yeah, probably.
would be one on there. yeah, so that's where they got the data for that.
Nice.
You know, but that's more style. Oriented, like what kinds of sentences do they use? It can't really address theme, which I think must play a big part in.
I would think
makes a book popular.
So we talked about what makes a book or a film popular, but clearly, especially in the case of film, being popular does not equate to being great.
Right.
So what makes a great book or a great film?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So for that, I mean, there's. Obviously a lot that could be said on that. As a jumping off point, I found...
However, what will be said here is the definitive
answer. Definitive answer, right.
So, look no
so
further,
you're lucky that
listeners.
you're listening to us. You'll learn the truth of the question. But as a jumping off point, I found this list of criteria for a great book compiled by the Italian writer Italo Calvino.
Hmm.
You know, and this is from brainpickings.org, which, you know...
Sounds
is the most reliable
yeah.
source
let's
on the internet.
let's pull some of his points.
Okay. So, I'll take one and then you take one. And
okay.
So, this is according to this writer, Calvino. The classics are those books about which you usually hear people saying, I'm rereading, never, I'm reading. So, the point, obviously, being that the classics are books that people return to again and again. Rather than...
Sure.
Yeah.
Which seems obvious enough. I mean, obviously if they're classics, they've
yeah.
been around long enough that people have been rereading them. Or
right, and
them
the
or what
same
have you.
Person evidently, you know, can get
something
more
different
and more out
it,
of
from
it.
From a second reading.
Every time.
Which I think is fair enough. And maybe it seems obvious, but I suppose it's worth saying.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's, you know... If you just have an average book... That's like, oh, it's okay, but it's not a classic, it's not going to stand the test of time. You're not
yeah.
going to reread it.
You know? Right. You may just, like, you know, you read, like, a...
Some
know,
thriller or
a
something.
A thriller
yeah.
or, like, a mystery or something. It's like, oh, this is good.
Right,
whatever.
Right.
So, what's the next point he makes? Classics are those books which constitute a treasured experience for those who have read and loved them, but they remain just as rich an experience for those who reserve the chance to read them for when they are in the best condition to enjoy them.
Yeah, I don't really get that one.
I don't either.
Let's just skip it.
All right. The classics are books which exercise a particular influence, but when they imprint themselves on our imagination as unforgettable and when they hide in the layers of memory distinguished as the individuals or the collective unconscious. that one's clear.
That one's pretty lucid.
That seems fairly vague. I mean,
well, let me reread it a sec.
Classics and books.
I think something about it having a universal appeal or the collective unconscious, right? Sort of a Jungian idea, I suppose. I don't know.
Yeah.
So, good point. Okay, a classic is a book which with each rereading offers as much of a sense of discovery as the first reading. So, of course, that taps into what we
taps
were talking
into
about.
The first one, yeah.
At first, yeah. So it has to be have a level of richness that allows the reader to find new things each time. Or I've heard it described to some famous writer whose name I forget as like a classic generates an excess of symbols or an excess of images or something that allows people to wrestle with it, you know, for generations.
Yeah, that's fair. It looks like the next two or three points just kind of reiterate that same theme
mm-hmm.
in different words.
Yeah, he's got like 14 points here, so there's quite a bit.
Yeah, I think that last one bears
reading. Yeah, yeah, give that one a go.
So a classic is a work which persists as a background noise even when a present that is totally incompatible with it holds sway. So it's something you just can't really, humanity as a whole or what have you, can't really ignore.
Yeah, it's even always there.
Even when there's some other mindset or some other dominant culture in play.
It's not popular, maybe the popular opinion
right,
or something.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you think of some of the classic epics or something along those lines.
Mm-hmm.
And why is it that Homer holds sway now?
Mm-hmm.
Even though what he writes about has very little bearing on.
Yeah, yeah.
Modern life, you know? Like, why is it that we still are interested in Achilles and Hector, even though...
it's obviously not the world we live in.
It's not the world we live in, you know? We don't go around...
You know, and yet, in some ways, it is the world we live in, insofar as it addresses those universal and timeless human concerns, I suppose. This reminds me of... I found this interesting list, kind of like this, which I didn't have time to include, but it was something like the 10 stories that shaped the modern world, or shaped the world, by, I think it was a BBC thing.
Sure.
And the Odyssey was number one.
Oh.
Just as sort of this foundational
the great search
text
kind of thing
of Western culture, you know, dealing with family, obviously, and what it means to have a home. You know, as well as just the great character, or the complex character that Odysseus is. Mm. So, Google that.
Sure.
Since we don't have time to cover it, but I don't necessarily agree with all of the books they put on there, but I thought it was interesting that the Odyssey was put first.
That is interesting.
And it was ranked. This list was voted by like a bunch of academics who are not necessarily reliable, but. I think there's a compelling case you could make for the Odyssey.
Yeah, I think that's fair. And I think it is interesting, books like that, you know, the classics, especially the ancient classics, why are those still popular?
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
What is it about the Greeks that has any bearing on us? You know, we don't
have
that much in common with them on a pragmatic level.
And this is where I get into arguments... not arguments, but disagreements with, for example, professors in my graduate program, where they, you know, they would say something like, the reason that those books persist is simply because they've been culturally assimilated, and the Western patriarchy, you know, continues
sure.
to promote them. For example, there's nothing about, say, Keats, John Keats' Ode to a Nightingale that would appeal to, or no, like John Keats, I don't know, the point being that it's
like,
not universal, there's nothing universal
right.
in literature.
It just so happens that these texts help to fill in the blank with whatever agenda you want to,
so,
you know,
yeah, supposedly is being...
sling mud at or whatever.
Yeah,
you know,
pushed
like
on the world.
The Western patriarchy mm-hmm. finds that Keats really does help support their ideals of oppression
and that's why it persists.
Belittlement
yeah.
of, you know, of others and what have you.
No, but yeah.
And that's why it's around, is because the Western patriarchy has handpicked it as something which will, you know, shore it up
mm-hmm.
and what have you.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't really make a lot of sense to me.
Right, yeah, I think that's where I would argue that the reason these works persist is because there is something timeless
right, I think
about
there is
them.
Something about them that people just can't quite shake off, you know, it's like...
And so they must be appealing to something that is universally true.
Right.
That people can universally relate to and recognize.
Right.
And I suppose something of that would be true for films as well. This list was about, this particular, Calvino's list is about books, but I think some of this would apply to film.
Yeah. I think that, I think that in literature, you know, a common theme is mortality.
Yeah, right, sure.
Kind of coming to some reckoning with that. I mean, that's the theme in Iliad and to some degree in the Odyssey.
It's about as universal as it gets.
Yeah, yeah. They all die.
Yeah.
And I think there may be something in maybe some of the films on the top 10 list or whatever that reckon with that as well, albeit in a more populist way.
Yeah, that could be true. Can you think of a specific...
I don't know. Example? I mean, I think that I haven't seen Infinity War, but that's the top, isn't it?
Infinity War, yeah.
Infinity, I said Infinity. I haven't seen Infinity War, but isn't the villain Thanos?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Which is sort of a play on the, you know, the Greek Thanatos, which is death.
Okay.
You know, I mean, you could argue that there's something there where there's sort of a reckoning with death.
No, that's a good perspective.
And on I haven't seen the film. You've been considering. Yeah. Because the spoiler alert as to whether that is true.
Spoiler alert. I'm sure everyone's already seen it, but if you haven't, this is a spoiler. A huge proportion of the like half the characters, basically die at the end. Although it's unclear exactly whether they're dead or just in some other dimension or what, you know, what's going on there, but...
Right, because they have to make a fourth.
Because they have to make a fourth, yeah, so...
Right, but I think the idea is that...
They just go into the void, sort of. They blow away in the as dust in the wind, basically.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you could make that claim, I suppose. There's that universal appeal. It's easier to talk about, for me, with literature than...
It is for me, too, especially with the top 10 films, because they're so... populist, in the sense that they're just sort of handpicked by the, you know, I hate to say it, but the lowest common denominator. It's like
it seems like democracy kind of thing.
Well, and a democracy of the people who go to the theater, which is not necessarily going to be the highest echelon of society.
Right.
No offense.
Right. Yeah. Well. No. But it's just.
It's like, you know, the. Whatever they're just regular. It's and the 18 to 30 demographic, you know. Yeah, it's not like it's not like that's the whole population.
But. To be fair, I mean, I really like going to the theater myself, so it's nothing against those people, but they're just regular people, I suppose.
Yeah, but it seems to be that what drives film in terms of popularity, there must be something about the visual element.
Yeah, well, part of it with film is it has to be a spectacle.
Yeah. You that's know. Part of it.
And so you'll see, like, with all the top 10 that we named, they're big box, big explosions, right. Big was visuals, like
the big 3D,
beautiful people, you know.
That was a thing. And
so that interferes maybe somewhat with it because it is all about spectacle with film.
Yeah.
And just in general, I don't think that the most popular films or books are necessarily the greatest.
No.
You know, like we mentioned earlier. So that. There's a difference there, but
yeah.
I was just gonna add my own two cents again, cause like we haven't been doing that before.
Right now, let's
we'll add a little more of my opinion. What do you think, Juan? Yeah, so thanks for asking, Peter. What I think, I guess just that the best movies and films touch on the good, the true, and the beautiful, which would correlate back to universal, I suppose. If you know. If we accept the premise that what is good is universally good and universally appealing in some way, that's part of the matter. You know, like it's hard to imagine a great work of literature that has nothing to do with the good, nothing to do with the true, and nothing to do with the beautiful. You know, that would be, like, that doesn't sound very fun to read. I don't think anybody would really love that. I don't know.
It sounds fairly 21st century.
So, just for... what it's worth.
Yeah, no, I think that's true. And it's not that the good and the true is necessarily pleasant to read.
No, yeah. Right, it isn't necessarily.
Nor is the beautiful necessarily always easy
to deal with.
To deal with. It can sometimes be...
Right. Well, and part of the true certainly would be ugly things, too.
Now it would.
Well, yeah, I mean, but yeah. There's certainly
ugly
side to human nature, for example.
Right.
Has to be part of literature, but
you at think least of a it's novel true, like you know? The Road.
Yeah.
Not an easy book.
Right. Right, not at all.
Not what you would stereotypically think of as beautiful.
Right. But it is in some ways.
But it is quite beautiful. I mean, it is.
You know.
It touches on real. What's the word? Very fundamental themes of human existence and relationships.
Yeah.
And,
well, it's
and how do you hold on to a truth and goodness? You know, even in very adverse circumstances.
Well, it shows the love between the father and son persisting even in the worst
of
conceivable circumstances.
Yeah. So it's not easy to read.
Right. No.
But that'd be an example, you know, true, good, and beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
It's all of those.
But it's not easy. It's not easy. Yeah.
I think people tend to think of true, good, and beautiful as like
just la di da,
a Hallmark film, you know, something like that.
Right. But in some ways, yeah, that's maybe the initial thought. But a Hallmark film is lies in some ways,
right?
Because life isn't like that.
Soapy lies.
You know, so it's a lie. It's not the truth. But maybe just to conclude here, I had jotted down, why are books and films and their influence important cultural concerns? Like, why should we even care?
That's
what
true.
What books are the most popular? I mean, why do we...
Do books even matter?
Right. And what's your response to that?
Why should we care? Well, I mean, you are what you read. I think that that holds true even in a culture where most people don't have the attention span to read a whole book.
Right.
We are the ideas we consume. You know, as Aristotle says, we are what we repeatedly do. You become a part of what it is that you are exposed to on a regular basis. There's no way around that.
Sure.
You know, you take in ideas and those will have a real effect on how you act, whether you want that or not. If you constantly just sit down and watch, I don't know, pick any show, pick any film, you know, any type of thing, for example, in terms of visual stimulation, you will absorb a part of that and it will become a part of how you act. Same with reading, you know.
Just so this idea that the ideas, the values that you incorporate or assimilate... Mm. Have an impact on
I think so.
Decisions.
Right,
ultimately.
They do. They genuinely do. I think that's true. I mean, I'm just sort of pulling that out of thin air.
Well, yeah, but I think it's a tenable.
Right.
Theory.
I do think it's tenable, but I'm not going to have the time to defend it.
Yeah.
But I do think
in the last 2 minutes.
In the last 2 minutes, I think that you know you become what you consume.
Sure.
In terms of literature and film, and so, what do you want to be?
Right. What do you want to be? Well, and. Yeah, I mean, if you just think about, like, those top 10 lists we gave, the huge number of people who have been exposed to those particular words, those particular ideas, in some ways, you could argue, those books and those films have shaped the world.
Right, one way or another.
To some extent,
like
at
it,
least.
Hate it, don't care, they've shaped it.
Right. Because if what you're saying is true, that we are affected and we become, or in some way what we consume is a part of us, then, you know, Avatar is a part of our culture.
So, yeah.
That explains a lot. No,
no, but I think there's something to that, you know. If you want to take the pulse of a culture, you know, what does it produce?
Yeah. Yeah, wasn't the
those
whole...
Those are our works of art.
Yeah.
You know?
Isn't the whole idea with art that it's like a mirror?
It's a mirror for culture, for culture. And so that's sort of what we aspire to, you could argue.
Right, so I guess, you know, you can go back and look at those lists of the top-selling books and movies and... consider that a mirror of our culture and make of that what you will.
Yeah. What would you like to be?
So with that, I guess that concludes our second episode, and thank you all very much for listening. We'll be back next week.